Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the program today, we will debrief the week that was. We will go on the road again with Jim Fallows and our series American Futures. And we will ask this question. Seriously, $2 billion for a basketball team? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryznall. It is the 30th of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The big news this Friday is, of course, news of change at the top. This morning, the president said that he has accepted the resignation of Eric Shinseki, the retired four-star general who is now the former head of the Department of Veterans Affairs. That may take some of the political heat off of this scandal, but it does little to fix the much, much bigger problem. A management challenge, really. Figuring out what is wrong with the VA healthcare system and exactly how to fix it. Marketplace's David Gura starts us off.
This is a big job. Many people would say Eric Shinseki's successor will be in an unenviable position.
Good luck to whoever comes in.
Michael Useem heads the Center for Leadership and Change Management at the Wharton School.
This is a turnaround, a restructuring.
Something that has been done successfully, he notes, many times in the private sector. But the new head of the VA will face certain pressures someone in the private sector probably wouldn't. Tom Diano is a professor of health policy and management at Columbia.
It's a highly politicized environment with not a lot of resources to allocate.
About those resources, Jack Needleman is a public health professor at UCLA.
The system's growth in budget has been slower than the growth in the demand for services.
And that is in part because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The VA has a pretty big budget, but most of it is tied up in pensions and disability. It's possible Congress could step in and give the agency more money. Some lawmakers want to make it easier for the VA to hire and fire staff. But Needleman wonders if that should be at the top of the agenda.
What we've learned from decades of work studying health systems and quality is it's often a system problem, not a personnel problem.
And the Veterans Health Administration is a big system that's pretty decentralized. Tom Diano at Columbia says there will be some additional pressure to fix things fast. But, he adds, real reform would take time.
This is not about making heads roll. It's about doing actual problem solving.
Diano says the new secretary's first objective should be to build trust at the VA to find out exactly what's gone wrong. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Also gone from the president's staff today, although under far, far different circumstances, Press Secretary Jay Carney. No date yet for when he will actually leave his job. There was, of course, much, much else to talk about in the economy this week, so that is what we're going to do now for the next four or so minutes of live radio. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville is in our studios in New York. Neela Richardson from Redfin is in Washington for us. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Cardiff, let's go to gross domestic product. The number came out, yesterday, I guess. I was traveling. I don't know. I'm a little confused. Yesterday, it was not good. The economy contracted in the most recent quarter, 1%. Are you worried?
You know, I'm what you might call intensely ambivalent about this
I think
number,
you're just intense,
you know?
On everything.
Yeah. Well, it's like on the one hand, you don't want to just wave this away because I remember in the olden days when the economy, when it was strong enough, would grow through bad weather. You know, the season of winter is
literally
not like this
bad weather.
It's not like this new concept, the season of winter. On the other hand, we do know that towards the end of the quarter and since the quarter ended, it started to rebound. It's growing more strongly. So I think this just shows that the economic growth we have now isn't very robust. It's no time to get complacent, but it's not all bad news. Things are getting a little better.
Neela, it didn't take but about 4 seconds for my Twitter feed to light up yesterday morning with people saying, oh my gosh, one more quarter and we're back in a recession. Do you fear the two steps forward, one step back sort of spring swoon that we've become accustomed to?
Yes, I do. I do. What it would take for us to reach the 3% that the Fed has been forecasting is for us to grow in the second half of this year by 5%. Kai, I just don't see any evidence of where this growth is going to come. And the reason I'm so troubled is because business investment plummeted so much.
Right. That is to say the building up of inventories and putting stuff back on the shelves, right?
And construction of things, that means that the economy is growing. There's no indication that the seeds of growth that would hit 5% in the second half of the year are actually starting to bloom in the spring swoon.
Yeah, no green shoots. All right, Cardiff, a different economic number, inflation. also came out this week. It was up, you know, a tad, you know, 0.2%, whatever it is. We need a little inflation, right? Shouldn't we be rooting for inflation in this economy?
We should certainly be rooting for some gently rising inflation. Yeah. It has all kinds of beneficial effects. It also, by the way, can be a sign that the economy is starting to grow again. But the good thing about inflation when it doesn't spike too quickly is that it means that households are incentivized to spend money because their money is going to be worth a little bit less mm-hmm. each year. It also means that businesses are incentivized to invest. So the only worry here is if the Fed sees it, if policymakers see it and they decide that they want to start slowing down the economy because they worry about inflation rising, I don't think we're anywhere near that point. I think we should let it run for a little while.
Yeah, Neela, you agree with that? I mean, it's not like Janet Yellen's going to come out tomorrow and take away the punch bowl.
Absolutely not. And actually, yeah. Inflation is going at the pace that the Fed would like to see it right now. They're probably happy about this number. What consumers shouldn't be happy about is the other thing that they strip out of that core inflation rate, which is gas prices. They're
right.
up 40 cents this year. I think that's going to affect the consumer. We saw that the consumer is struggling a bit with the recent purchase numbers. And yeah. so that issue is something to keep a watch on.
All right. Fair enough. One last thing before I let you guys go. That old stock market adage of sell in May and go away. Had you sold at the beginning of this month? You'd have missed all kinds of highs, Cardiff.
Yeah, no, that stuff's nonsense. I tend to think, look, you know, nobody should be paying attention to these things. Certainly not normal, average, everyday people. You should just be investing for the long term and then not follow, you know, not paying too much attention to day-to-day volatility.
Neela, thoughts on that, or you just want to let that one go?
Volatility makes good news, not good investment. So
there
I agree with Cardiff.
All right. Neela Richardson from Redfin and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. We'll see you guys later. All right.
Have a Thanks, great weekend.
Scott. All right, we'll see you. Bit of a mixed bag, actually, at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. We will have the numbers, as we always do, when we have the numbers. If reports are to be believed, come Monday, the Environmental Protection Agency is going to make some news. It's going to officially announce the first ever regulations to limit greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants. That's a big deal, global warming-wise. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, though, didn't want to wait until Monday. Earlier this week, it put out a pre-buttle of sorts, saying, basically, that the White House plan is going to cost a whole bunch of money. Depending on how you look at the numbers, which are, right now, we have to say, guesses, it is going to cost a lot of money, this stuff. Or maybe it isn't. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that.
The chamber estimates that EPA's regulations could reduce U.S. gross domestic product by up to $51 billion a year. I run that number by Yale economist William Nordhaus. He's the inventor of climate economics. He does some quick math in his head.
That's a little more than 0.2% of GDP. So that would be 0.01% per year off the growth rate.
In other words, he says, given the enormous size of the U.S. economy, $51 billion is a rounding error. There's also the cost-benefit analysis. What are you getting for this money? In this case, you're hoping to mitigate global warming.
There's just no argument I've heard for postponing this because it is going to get worse, it is going to get more costly, and the longer we wait, the steeper up the damage curve we go.
I think of it like noticing a couple loose bricks on the wall of my house, and I call a repair guy and the estimate sounds really expensive. But if I don't get the work done now, it's going to be a huge expense later. I run that one by Dallas Boutra. He's an economist from Resources for the Future.
Dan, that's a really good analogy, that you have a problem that you know is inevitably going to catch up with you. And any single day, it seems to make sense to procrastinate.
Yeah, until the day the bricks start falling on your head. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
Speaking of costs, here's one. $2 billion, that it seems is the price the market will bear for the Los Angeles Clippers Basketball Club to be paid by former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer. Nobody is confirming anything yet. The deal would still have to be approved by the league. And there is the small matter of the billion-dollar lawsuit that current owner Donald Sterling's lawyer said late this afternoon he is going to file. But the deal is the buzz anyway. Ballmer is said to be worth as much as $20 billion, so he will have plenty left over for private islands in the leg. But it is still quite a splurge, so we asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison to report on just what Ballmer might be getting for all that money.
$2 billion is way more than what most analysts think the team is worth, with some valuing it at just above half a billion. But in the bonkers world of sports business, all that matters is what one super rich person will pay, says sports economist Andy Zimbalist.
He's not getting a sound economic investment. He's buying a big toy. It's a vanity purchase. He gets a lot of exposure, ego massaging.
And he's also in charge. Attorney Kenneth Shropshire directs the Wharton School Sports Business Initiative.
You have a great deal of control, and you don't have all the problems that come with having shareholders come into play.
One of the most valuable things he'll get is money from the team's next TV contract, says Clemson University sports economist Skip Sauer.
All of the big deals that we've seen in recent times that are really startling have been fueled by the money that's coming in from freshly negotiated or to-be-negotiated TV contracts.
Some estimate the Clippers' next deal could triple what they're making now. Take another L.A. team, the Dodgers. They sold for $2.1 billion. The new owners went on to sell the media rights for billions more in a 25-year agreement. The Clippers are playing better, but Zimbalist says there's no way the Clippers can match that.
The Dodgers are the Dodgers. They're the second top-branded team in Major League Baseball. The Clippers are just beginning to become an interesting team.
After the fiasco of Donald Sterling and the Clippers, Ballmer is also buying a hero's welcome for himself as the billionaire who spent big and saved the day. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
After work softball games, trust exercises, the every now and then semi-obligatory happy hour. Office workers know what I'm talking about. Corporate team building. But in this new economy full of part-timers, freelancers, and temps, freelance writer Ann Brinzer Shelton has some team building tips for an office of one.
I bet I'm wondering why I've called this meeting today. It has come to my attention as I review the figures from our last profit and loss statement, which seems to be written on the back of a Wendy's receipt. Come on, me in accounting. Can't we at least try to make these things look professional? That perhaps morale is a little low around here, which might be impacting the bottom line. While I hate to pick on any one individual, I've noticed some patterns of behavior in a number of key areas. Our manager of operations, me, is not doing a great job motivating her direct reports. Also me. To be frank, I am a pushover, and I allow myself to get away with a lot that might not fly at more professional organizations. For instance, while I'm impressed with my progress in Candy Crush Saga, when I took me on as administrative assistant, I was expecting some actual administrative work to get done. But I'm clearly not taking this role very seriously. I'm still waiting for me to get around to drafting those emails I promised to send out 2 weeks ago. But I didn't gather me here today to point blame at any one person or other, not that there are any others, but rather to build us up as a team. They say a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and this is especially true of single-link chains. So we're going to do some team building. We'll get to know ourselves a little better by playing that two truths and a lie game, where each participant, me, divulges two little-known facts about herself and makes another one up, and then the others, me, try to guess which is the lie. We'll also use this poster board and these markers to make a fun board game detailing our processes and the obstacles we frequently face in our daily work. Then we'll play a few rounds to see if we can't pinpoint some areas for improvement. I've also got some great collaborative activities that involve paper airplanes and thinking outside the box. Oh, and of course I should feel welcome to help myself to the several boxes of Krispy Kreme donuts I brought to kick off this fun-filled day of bonding and camaraderie. Now, who's going to volunteer to go first for the trust fall?
Yeah, not me. Ann Brinzer Shelton is, as you might have guessed, a freelance writer and editor. Her commentary originally appeared in McSweeney's. Coming up,
people viewed us as the guys were dipping snuff with no teeth, the girls were pregnant with no shoes, and all of a sudden, we were building stuff that flies.
That is what you call in radio a great piece of tape. Our series, American Futures, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Quiet day with some new all-time high, though, on this last day of the week and last day of the month on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials ticked up 18 points, more than a 10%. Record high there, 16,717. The Nasdaq off 5 points, a bit more than a 10%, finished at 42.42. The S&P 500 up 3 points, almost 0.2%, also a new high, 19.23. The Dow up 0.7% on the week, 0.8% on the month. The Nasdaq added 1.4% this week, 3.1% this month. The S&P 500 climbed 1.2% on the week, 2.1% in the month of May. Investors were selling shares in Express and Guess after the two apparel companies forecast disappointing profits for the quarter. Express off more than 7%, Guess down more than 5% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for April. He played the title character in Leave It to Beaver. Jerry Mathers turned 66. And June is National Candy Month. You may ask, why? But I think the real question is, why not? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you are among those who think America doesn't make stuff anymore, you got to come to Columbus, Mississippi.
They're opening the door of the furnace now.
This is a steel plant. It's owned by a Russian company called Severstal.
It's like straight out of the gate to hell, man. Oh, and here comes the water.
Jim Bell is one of almost 700 people who work in what is, for some reason, called a mini mill.
The name's a little deceiving.
And you can smell, you smell the burning.
After a while, you don't even smell anything.
Really? I bet you don't hear anything either.
Mini or not, from this plant in northern Mississippi is delivered 3.3 million tons of steel a year. And it is the starting point for our latest installment of our series, American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, we've got Tango for landing.
The series that we do with Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, and his wife Deb, it's the American economy by small private airplane, Jim's plane.
Columbus, Mississippi, and the surrounding counties are not where you would expect to see a giant steel mill, a helicopter factory, and all the rest. From 2,500 feet, it looks like a great big expanse, you know, many, many football fields worth of heavy industry under one roof. From ground level, I was reminded of the days I spent in these factories in China. It's as close as I've come to the Chinese industrial experience in the United States.
Columbus is a city that was built on industry, on manufacturing. But the way Jim just described that city today was not the reality of a decade ago when big chunks of the manufacturing in this part of Mississippi just went away.
This was American Trouser. It was a cut and sew garment manufacturer. They have been closed maybe 8 or 9 years.
Brenda Lathan has lived in Columbus most of her life. She had a job in a chemical factory for 13 years. She got laid off when the place was shut down, as a lot of places were back then. And now she works in economic development for the city of Columbus.
This is pretty much your classic rundown factory. I mean, it's literally overgrown with weeds and beer bottles in the parking lot. How many people used to work here?
Oh, they probably had about 300 people at one point in time.
Where did these jobs go?
Overseas, China.
What do you think when you look at this place?
I'm heartbroken. We had a facility here that could employ a large majority of our population, and now we don't have that anymore.
This region lost a third of its manufacturing jobs back in the 90s, jobs that were gone to China and all over the world until this guy came along.
My name is Joe Max Higgins, Jr. I'm the CEO of the Golden Triangle Development Link.
We are standing here in the middle of nowhere, man.
Correct. Or we could say the epicenter of the tire industry. I don't know.
The epicenter of the tire industry. And it turns out, a whole lot more. We're standing on what will eventually be Yokohama Boulevard, named, of course, after the Japanese company. Construction crews are churning up the rich black dirt, building Yokohama's new $1.2 billion tire plant right on the outskirts of town.
I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but who'd have thought that you'd find this in the middle of North Mississippi?
Yeah. Well, you know, people viewed us as, you know, the guys were dipping snuff with no teeth. The girls were pregnant with no shoes. We can't read and write, and half the people burn a cross in somebody's yard on Friday or Saturday night for fun. That's how the world would view us. And all of a sudden, we were building stuff that flies. And I don't mean flies a little bit. I mean flies real well.
Stuff that flies. Airbus picked Columbus for its new helicopter factory back in 2006.
Now, I tell people, I said, from that project on, the people just started, I mean, they started standing up and being proud.
And they grow on each other, right? I mean, yeah. You do one and everybody knows you can do it, so.
Yeah, yeah. And these other projects are witness to that.
And those projects, including, just to pick one, the Israeli firm Stark Aerospace, have brought $4.7 billion in investment and almost 6,000 jobs to northern Mississippi in the past decade. You got people, though, who don't know that they can build stuff that flies, going out and building stuff that flies, right? There's a workforce question here.
Well, a lot of people say, well, they can't do it. Well, I mean, we went up to the steel mill. We went into what I would consider to be one of the most sophisticated operations industrially I've ever been in. It's where they melt the steel. You had two young men there, one white, one black. Both of them had been in that job for 7 years. That's how long the mill's been in operation. One of them was a sheriff's deputy, and one of them was an offshore worker. And they said, we'd never made steel before in our life, and yet we watched them run the newest, most critical process in that without a hitch.
And they're making what kind of wages?
Before benefits, the last state audit, they were making $80,000 a year average at the plant.
And in an area where the normal household income is what?
$36,000.
So how exactly do you take a sheriff and an offshore oil worker and turn them into high-tech manufacturing workers? The answer is literally just up the road from Severstal Steel. It's in a blue-roofed building that houses the Workforce Development Department of East Mississippi Community College, or EMCC, to the locals. It's really funny. You can see the connection between the stuff here in the school and the stuff we just saw in the factory.
This is exactly the same. Yeah. The only thing is the size.
Yeah, that's bigger and scarier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Guy, stop playing over there.
Well, come on. This is all cool stuff. Raj Shaunak runs the program using helicopters and truck engines and computers donated by the companies that have come to Columbus to help train people to work at those companies. He did it for Severstal, and now he's doing the same for Yokohama, even though that billion-dollar tire factory isn't going to be finished for another year.
Other than Mr. Yamamoto and his assistant, everyone, HR to engineers, have to go through this pathway.
So when Yokohama shows up mm-hmm. and their plant is ready to go, they're going to have a fully trained workforce.
Right. Phase one is 500 employees. We are charged to have 5,000 qualified people, 10 to 1.
Wow.
Means you're going to have 4,500 disappointed graduates.
Yeah, right?
They have higher skills now. They are more marketable.
They're more marketable to factories like PACCAR. Again, just down the road, Mississippi State Route 82. Because seriously, all these places are actually pretty close together.
Okay, let's walk this way.
Yep. PACCAR makes truck engines. Semi-truck engines, the big ones, for one out of every 10 semis that are on the road in this country. And they make them right here in Columbus. Scott Blue runs the place.
We're on the cylinder head side of the line right now.
Okay, you know what's interesting? We've been in here for, 30 seconds, maybe a minute? I still have not seen a human being doing anything. PACCAR is a 500,000-square-foot, 400-employee, heavily automated, high-tech facility. Workers start out making around $20 an hour with full benefits and a 401k.
This is kind of an interesting realization, but I would not be able to work at this place, right? Because I don't have the skills. I don't have the engineering skills. I don't have the computer skills.
Well, you can learn those skills.
I guess.
But that's part of what the community college helps us with. Yeah. Here's a good example.
That good example is a guy named Scott Crowley. His job at PACCAR is cold testing the engines, basically checking them out before they're shipped.
I came from Omnova. I had 23 years in Columbus, Mississippi, but we shut the plant down. It was factory work, but like you said, this new technology they have here with the computers and everything, it's really big change for me.
You worked in another plant for 23 years.
Right.
It closed down.
Right.
So you're a 45-year-old guy, plus or minus, without a job.
Right.
Do you have computer background? Do you have technology background?
Not much at all. But when I got here, I got trained now.
Did you go to college, junior college? What'd you do?
1 year, East Mississippi. And that was it, you know, and I was in forestry, so nothing
in
to do.
Forestry?
Right, yeah. I had nothing to do here. But I was worried that I'd been in a place for 23 years, and their technology was not up to date. I was worried about that. But, you know, they gave me a shot, and I told them, well, I'm hoping to get another 20 years here.
I was just going to say, is this your last job? You're going to do 20 years here?
I hope it is. Couldn't have been asked to be blessed no better than that.
to be clear, what Columbus has done, six new multinationals that have opened up in the past couple of years, has not yet replaced all the manufacturing jobs the city lost. But if you still somehow think manufacturing is dead in this country, like I said, you got to come to Columbus, Mississippi. There is more on American Futures, some great video of Columbus and of those factories, plus where we've gone, where we're thinking about going, and a link to Jim's blog at The Atlantic as well. It's all online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which comes to us from the Marketplace desk of, yes, the internet is actually making us stupid. Google apparently changed its logo this week. Nothing major, really, just a tweak, a tiny tweak, you might say. It moved the second G one pixel to the right. It moved the L one pixel down and one pixel to the right. Makes it more readable, apparently. And no, sadly, I am not making this up. There is a GIF. Yes, I pronounced that GIF. That is the proper way, but that's a whole different final. Anyway, there's a GIF on our website that will make this all make perfect sense to you. I think, maybe, I don't know. All right, we got to go. That is Marketplace from APM this Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.